Welcome to London School of Economics. This is the fourth session of the Ideas of 1989 series. My name is Meghnad Desai. I'm chairing this roundtable this afternoon, and I'm very pleased that we have a distinguished panel, one of whom is yet to arrive, but I'm sure he will turn up here. Unless the stars you have got him this time. I don't think so. We have four speakers, and I shall start with Neil Acheson, who will be familiar to many of you as a columnist and a journalist, or a journalist and a columnist. And I certainly remember reading him on questions of Central and Eastern Europe, on Scotland, and on many other subjects. And I think he... if you wouldn't mind me saying so, he could combine passion with rationality in a way in which very few people can in a column. And it always seemed that after one had read his column sort of early on Sunday morning, one was fully awake, because it's a troublesome and thought-provoking. And after that, you know, the day had changed. And I have very good memories of that. So I'll first ask Neil to speak. I hope this thing works.
Right. Can you hear me?
Can you hear him?
Am I audible?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Now, I want to make several disconnected remarks to you, which are more in the nature of questions. In a sense, it's a funny way to introduce this discussion, which I'm thankful to say is not a commemoration, because I have become, frankly, a little bit choked with some of the quality and content of the commemorative sessions, rallies, meetings, and gatherings over the last week or so, because they have been inevitably, rightly, to some extent, self-congratulatory, but more important than that, they have been, in the usual postmodern way, they have been influenced by presentism, as François Hartog puts it, in the sense that history is being quite cheerfully molded, selected, reshaped, and dumped in front of us in order to fit what people consider to be the purposes and requirements of the present. And the study of commemorations is, of course, an extraordinarily popular and fashionable study, as those of you who study history, archaeology, the history of ideas, all the rest of it, will know very well. And this commemoration is no less worthy of skeptical, critical, rigorous study than any other. Having said that, I'm not yet qualified to do it, but all I want to do is I want to point out one or two of the rather striking, to me, absences in the content of these commemorative sessions and speech makings which we've been through. The first one is the absence of the concept of nationalism. This has almost completely disappeared. My own experience of what took place in 1989, however, is that these were revolutions carried on the traditional vehicle of national emancipatory revolution, as they had been repeatedly in Central and Eastern Europe into the 19th century past. And as so often, those with hopes, those with ambitions, those with unsatisfied energies, those with a love of freedom and the truth and all the rest of it, loaded, as they always had loaded, these hopes onto the traditional vehicle which rolls them through obstacles into reality, and that was the idea of the independent nation state. In some cases, as you know, this really was, as in the Baltics, for example, a matter of creating a nation state where none had been before. So it was nationalism of a quite traditional kind, as well as of liberating, emancipatory into the 21st century kind. In others, it was a ferocious, and sometimes, of course, as in the case of Romania, bloodthirsty, coming to grips with those who had betrayed and besmirched, if you like, the nation's vision or ideal of itself in recent history. So that this idea, the nationalist element, the idea of national struggle and national independence, was, to me, one of the leading characteristics in all the iconography, in all the rhetorical tricks of 1989, Germany being a slight exception, but not even a total exception there. And that aspect of what happened 10 years ago is now entirely absent from the discourse which you listen to, except possibly in the Baltics, where, anyway, the timing was somewhat different. The second thing which I noticed by its absence is any serious reference, and this is something which Tim can talk about more effectively than I can, of the kind of social and political philosophy which moved the opposition movements in Central and Eastern Europe, East Central Europe, at that time, because this group of beliefs, which of course, as many of you will remember or know, proceeded, in fact, from a kind of libertarian Marxism, and they were about the idea of a self-managing society, which was egalitarian, in which certainly the state receded from the economy and from the management and dictation over society, but it was to be replaced by a network of self-managing unities, workers' control factories, offices running their own affairs, services run by the consumer, whatever it was. There were many, many ideas of this, but they were all within a framework of ideas which was essentially idealistic, left-wing Marxist. In some ways, you could trace its ancestry, if you were interested, back to ideas of the soon-to-be-suppressed workers left in the early years of the Russian Revolution, and indeed before. However, that element, which was, to me, the sort of carrying philosophy of liberty which moved most of these oppositions forward into what they did, and in particular into their continuous striving, first of all to set up open spaces in which liberty could happen within the working class and within large places of employment. Secondly, to establish a link, which in those years seemed to be the crucial tactical link to establish in order to bring revolution about, between the industrial working class and its colossal inflated workplaces and the intellectual stratum. All these struggles, all these ideas have been, for the moment, entirely forgotten and buried because they, frankly, are no longer convenient to remember and they appear to be somewhat irrelevant. And indeed, even as 1989 happened, those ideas were already falling very much out of fashion with what you might call the second line and the third rank and the fourth rank of opposition, the great mass of particularly younger people who longed to overthrow these regimes and replace them with something else. I mean, and their mood was much, much more of what we would now call right-wing in many, many ways. Anybody who expressed sympathy for Nicaragua was practically spat on. Indeed, I remember a Polish woman said to me the day before yesterday, said she was at school in the 1980s, and she said, you know, we regarded capitalism as something noble. So this was rapidly, a tide rapidly rising around the ankles, knees, and hips of the heroic generation of people who actually made the revolution. But by the time they made the revolution, believe me, that was, it differed from one country to another, but that tide was up around their knees. Now, I won't go on about this because my time is running out in 10 minutes, but there's one other thing I want to just state, another absence. It is very easy to become used to a world in which Russia is weak, in which Russia is not a formidable player on the world stage. And I noticed this in many of these commemorations, that there was a, not exactly a nostalgia for the old Soviet Union with which one could deal, but there was, I think, a failure to appreciate that Russian weakness at the moment in world politics is not something permanent. It is, it may be, a consequence of what happened between 1989 and 1991, or you can draw the boundary rather wider at each end, of course. It may be so, but the evidence that this is the permanent condition of things and that we will not fairly soon, within the next 10 to 12 years, return to a situation in which Russia is an immensely powerful and to some extent incalculable force and superpower in the world. I mean, not to understand that the situation in which we live is a window situation. It may be a window of opportunity, which we're not using, but it's certainly not a situation which is going to last. And I found, you know, that that kind of understanding of the position of Russia was absent. So that's all I wanted to say. Those three, I wanted to make those three points, ask those three questions. Why wasn't there understanding of the role of nationalism? Why has this been found inconvenient to remember? Why has it been found inconvenient to remember the extraordinary, very dramatic, very brilliantly expressed set of philosophies about democratic self-management which the leading generation of the opposition carried through into the revolution? And why do we not appreciate that the weakness of Russia is not a lasting condition? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Our second speaker is Timothy Gadnash, who for many of us mapped the whole Eastern Central European movement from its very beginning. His books are all over the place, as you see, and he is running this brilliant television series on BBC, which is how I know that he was born on 12th of July, 1955, because I saw his certificate, the Stasi certificate. And so we share the same star sign.
There you are.
which is a prediction of nothing, but all I know is that you're waiting to hear him and not me.
Well, thank you very much. I don't know what follows from the fact that we're both cancer. I wasn't entirely clear exactly what the title of this session was, whether it was the ideas of 1989 or the global significance of 1989, which are obviously two rather different things. I've just chosen to talk about the first one. I mean, I think the first thing we have to ask is which 1989, because the term is much used and abused. Are we talking about the original Central European 1989 of the Velvet Revolutions, which I think Neil was mainly talking about, and which I'd like to mainly talk about? Are we talking about Romania? Are we talking about the former Yugoslavia, which had its own 1989? Are we talking about Russia, which had a very different 1989? Are we talking about China, which, of course, had its own very significant but completely different 1989, when history turned in China on the 4th of June 1989, the day of the historic Polish elections, which brought Solidarity to power? History in China turned in exactly the opposite direction. I'll never forget watching in the offices of a Polish newspaper, the opposition Polish newspaper, Gazeta Wyborcza, as the first election results were coming in, the first pictures from China of the tanks on Tiananmen Square. Or are we talking about the global 1989, as Michael Ignatieff interpreted his in 1989 in his rival television program? That is to say, the whole impact, consequences, alleged consequences of the end of communism, the end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, the end perhaps of the divide between left and right, all of that. Perhaps we can come back to that in the discussion. I think that many of the things ascribed to 1989, in inverted commas, are only very dubiously of 1989. For example, economic globalization. Well, sure, the end of the Soviet bloc brought another, 300 million consumers and producers into the world market. But globalization had happened a lot long before 1989 and went on spreading long after. I mean, in China, for example, it started with the economic reform. So I don't think economic globalization is really a specific legacy of 1989. Moral globalization, as Michael put it, well, I wish Michael were here to discuss it, but I again have my doubts. Sure, it gave a push to the idea of human rights and certainly of civil society, but if you take one of the most prominent features of moral globalization, namely the idea of international humanitarian law, international criminal court, prosecution of war crimes, this is not an idea of 1989. It's an idea of 1945, which is revived after 89. So we could talk more about that, but I think I would rather focus on what seems to me the central 1989, historically 1989, that is, the central European 1989 of the Velvet Revolutions. And I want to concentrate on just one thought, really, which arises from a couple of sentences in my book about 1989, my book We the People, where I said in the epilogue that it seemed to me that 1989 had produced no big new ideas about the organization of human society. The ideas whose time had come were old, well-tried ones, I asserted. This, by the way, was one reason why François Furet, the great historian of the French Revolution, didn't consider 1989 to have been a revolution, measured by the French standard. He went around the world certifying revolutions. Did they measure up to that standard? And most of them were found wanting, and so was this one. And one of the reasons he gave was precisely that it didn't produce any major new ideas about the organization of human society. And so it seemed to me that it was actually the opposite, in one way, of 1848. Both 1848 and 1989 were revolutions of the intellectuals. They were led by intellectuals. 1848 left nothing but ideas. 1989, I'm almost inclined to say, left nothing but realities. Although I'll qualify that statement in a moment. Now, this assertion of mine, this rather bold assertion, then became the subject of friendly polemics, I have to say, between three people on this platform, because apart from Anthony Barnett from Charter 88, who, I don't know if he's lurking somewhere here. Anthony, are you there somewhere? No. Who launched in to attack the statement. I think Barbara Einhorn did attack it in the Journal of END, if I remember, and certainly Neil did in the nicest possible way in The Independent on Sunday. And I have the article here. It's what makes very interesting reading. Because Neil, if I may, started out by comparing it, or inclusion compared it to 1848, and said 1848 and thrown some new and untested ideas onto the shore of history, a wonderful Ashersonian phrase, and went on, I quote, "I think that 1989 caused a European mutation, introducing a new gene. It is carried by all these forums, even though they will probably wither away in the next year or so." Pretty good guess. "It's about self-managing societies, about the decline of state authority, about a new kind of power-sharing deal between the wealthy and the producers of wealth, about the rise of nationalities and the fall of nation-states." Well, that seems to me a marvelous summary of what the hopes of 1989 were. That is to say, there were many hopes of doing things differently. But if we look at what's happened 10 years on, well, there were hopes of all these forums, of a new kind of forum of politics, movement politics, anti-politics. Havel, for example, was very reluctant to see Czechoslovakia, as it then was, go over to ordinary party politics. Gone with the wind, blown away. What you have all over, certainly post-communist Central Europe, is party politics as we know them, or rather worse. Self-managing societies, Neil rightly said, a dream of the solidarity movement in Poland, gone with the wind. No sign of it that I can see anywhere in post-communist Central Europe. The decline in state authority, well, yes, to the extent that authority has been usurped by the mafia, but not by self-organized societies. A new kind of power-sharing deal between the wealthy and the producers of wealth, well, some of you may have seen the first film in our series where we went back to Gdańsk to look at what had happened to the workers in the Lenin shipyard. We find them being exploited in a very familiar way in small private companies, most of which don't even have trade unions, actually ban trade unions. So, you know, the old joke, what's the difference between communism and capitalism? Answer, in capitalism, it's the exploitation of man by man. In communism, it's the other way around. Well, that was an East European joke under communism, but now it's turned around the other way. So not much to be seen of that, a new model of the economy. The rise of nationalities and the fall of nation states. Well, the rise of nationalities and, by Jove, the rise of national states. In my book, History of the Present, I have a map, two maps, Europe 89, Europe 99. On the second map, there are 15 new nation states in Europe. 15 new nation states in Europe. So it's, in a sense, 1848 come true. That is to say, each nationality creating its nation state. Other hopes of that time. There was a great hope of a sort of moral renewal. The Pope saw Central Europe as a kind of Central Europe Piedmont, of a spiritual risorgimento. Not much sign of that. Civil society in power, as Jerzy Dienspier called it. Again, I don't see it. A great hope of the revolutions of 1989 was, of course, what was called the return to Europe and the healing of Europe, that somehow a historically unjust and brutal artificial division of Europe would be overcome with the two halves of Europe coming together as equal partners. Well, 10 years on, not much sign of that, although in this case, the fault, of course, lies with us in the West, not with people in the East. So I think that most of the new ideas that there were in 1989 have actually not been realized, have been disappointed, have been blown away by bad copies of what we have in the West, or something worse. But with one qualification, and here I end, with one qualification. I think that the new idea of the revolutions of 1989 was the revolution itself. It was not the what, not the goal, but the how, the means. It was the non-revolutionary revolution, the peaceful revolution, the evolutionary revolution. Considered a contradiction in terms until that time. Another reason why François Furet didn't give it the certificate of approval. I remember someone, an ordinary bloke in the streets of East Berlin just after the fall of the wall, 10 years ago, more or less today, saying to me, you know, we've proved Lenin wrong. Because Lenin said, you can't have a peaceful revolution. We've had a peaceful revolution. And I think this really was a very major and lasting discovery of 1989. I think the fundamental insight of the opposition, of the democratic opposition, as it developed in Central Europe in the 70s and 80s, was that you cannot separate ends from means, that the means you adopt will affect the end, the outcome. You cannot lie your way through to the truth. Adam Michnik, who I believe spoke here a couple of weeks ago, put it marvelously. He said, those who begin by storming Bastille will end up building their own Bastille. And therefore you had to start as you meant to go on. And I think the lasting significance of 1989, taken to mean the 1989 of the Velvet Revolutions, not all the consequences of the end of Cold War and communism, but specifically of the Velvet Revolutions, was the discovery of this new model of revolution, which replaced a model which, more or less with variations, had after all been accepted in place for 200 years since 1789. A new model of revolution which went from social self-organization through the organization of mass peaceful civil disobedience of a very inventive kind to elite negotiation with the power holders, a negotiation of a peaceful transfer of power based on compromise, based very consciously on compromise. I mean, that's to put on a postcard what the new model of revolution is. So that, I think, is the big idea of 1989 and the idea of 1989 that still endures and has relevance today. Thanks.
Thank you. Our third speaker is Barbara Einhorn. She is very active in END, especially in East Germany. She's now the director of the Center for Women's Studies at Sussex. And as you probably saw outside, her books are on display. One of them is called Cinderella Goes to the Market. It's about citizenship, gender, and if I can read my own handwriting, women's movement. No, something
yes,
like that.
That's yes, right.
In Central and Eastern Europe. And she is, with Mary Calder, she's jointly edited a book on citizenship and democracy in Central and Eastern Europe. And recently edited a special issue of the European Journal of Women's Studies on the idea of Europe. Barbara Einhorn. Can I get it up?
No.
Why don't you have my one?
Oh, mine.
I'll have yours.
I want to. Is it on?
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to start with a small joke. It comes from a conference I spoke at earlier today called The Fall of the Wall. And when I received the email giving me the program of that conference, it was entitled as its subject, Wall of the Wall. I thought this was rather a charming typo, but actually perhaps had some substance in that one could ask the extent to which the wall did fall. We know that we have had systemic change, or rather that they have had systemic change, but the question is to what extent have the ideals of 1989 borne fruit? And I would say, as I think following on very nicely from what Neil and Tim have said, that there were paradoxes, there are paradoxes and contradictions. There are on the one hand openings, but also closures. We have, for example, thinking of the wall itself, history repeating itself as farce in its partial rebuilding as theatrical prop or tourist attraction. And on the other side, what the East German dissidents used to call the wall in our heads, I would say is still alive and well. In Germany itself, or in Berlin, for example, there are still two Berlins. There is an invisible line there. And I just heard a statistic today that 40% of West Germans have never, since 1989, visited anywhere in East Germany. They didn't think it worth their while. I wanted to pick up on something that Tim said in his book, The File. He went back to the notion of national identity, quoting Ernest Renan's 1889 article, What is a Nation? And he says it's a collectivity or a community based on collective remembering, but also collective forgetting, what Hobsbawm, in fact, called invented traditions. And it's interesting that this is what is happening in the two Germanies, I would say. And particularly interesting is that what they remember and what they forget are, of course, different things. And just very briefly, you might say that their selective memories are such that the East remember, for example, lost security, whereas the West remembers the East as a nation of Stasi informers. This is, in a way, a repeat in the Germans' constant efforts to come to terms with their past of the divided memories. This is the title of a recent book by Jeffrey Herf, in the post-war era in relation to the Shoah, where the West accepted, as it were, the legacy of Nazism and therefore related to and paid reparations to the victims of fascism, whereas the East, where the first ruling class members came back from forced emigration or from concentration camps, therefore saw themselves as the victims of fascism and hence constructed a collective identity or invented tradition of anti-fascism and thus did not relate to that legacy of the Shoah. So we have a continuity of this split, divided memory in the construction, in the reconstruction of national identities, in particular case of Germany. Looking then also, again with my question in mind of how much the wall has fallen or how much the wall in our heads is still there, thinking about the idea of Europe, it's very striking wherever you go, whatever conferences you speak at, the extent to which Europe is still equated, particularly by West European speakers, with the EU. And this reminds me of the time before 1989, when I don't know how many of you were familiar with the map of East Berlin. The map of East Berlin showed East Berlin in great detail, excluding, of course, things like the Stasi prison, where I spent some time, that was a blank on the map, as was after the line which indicated the Berlin Wall, there was a white space, a very large white space, which would suggest that if you were so foolhardy as to venture across this line, you would fall off into nothingness. And it seems to me that post-89, even 10 years later, what we have is the situation reversed. There is a notion that this line still exists. It may have moved somewhat further east, but if you venture beyond it, indeed you will fall out of history or into nothingness. The question is Europe enlarged and inclusive, or is it becoming a new exclusionary supranational state, that is, the EU? Where once the Berlin Wall kept people on the other side in, we now have Fortress Europe keeping migrants, would-be migrants, out. Looking then at the ideals of the peace movement, and specifically of END, the Campaign for European Nuclear Disarmament, which I was involved with together with Mary and others, and the our partners, the unofficial peace and human rights groups in East and Central Europe, what we thought we were about was undermining enemy images. Now, it seems to me that 10 years later, what we have is othering and creating enemy images in rather a big way, discriminating and indeed persecuting those perceived as others is something which is also alive and well. And for that, we don't need to look as far afield as Kosovo or Chechnya. We can look at the in Central Europe, which people regard as more civilized, perhaps, at the Czech town, which has built a wall around the area where the gypsies live. So there are new walls going up in Europe, literal walls. Or closer to home, we can see the proposed changes to the British asylum legislation, which will stigmatise asylum seekers by giving them vouchers rather than cash and condemning them to live on 70% of the poverty level. And here I'm going to go back to something Neil said in this exchange, which Tim has already mentioned, published in a book edited by Mary called Europe from Below in 1991. He said at that time, the politics of hatred is, of course, a well-tested Western model. And this was in his questioning of Tim's contention that the revolutions of 1989 hadn't brought new ideas, but rather a reversion to a tried and well-tested model of Western liberal democracy. I would rather support what Neil said, that indeed what we are seeing are the politics of hatred as a Western legacy. And what we are also seeing, I think, is an enduring wall of mistrust between people, which I personally see as the corrosive legacy both of the Stasi system or other security systems in East and Central Europe, but also of the Cold War more generally. And its impact on the social movements of 1989 has been, and indeed on the Western left, one might say on the West European left, has been profound. I think there have been openings in the sense that there are some topics which can now be discussed where they couldn't previously. One such topic in the case again of East Germany is Jewishness, which, as I said before, was a non-topic. It's only now that, for example, the political trials of 1952 and 1953 can be seen as having had some anti-Semitic content. However, it is also a time where we have renewed anti-Semitic attacks. And another topic which I think, another marker of difference, which I think has become less visible perhaps, is the topic of gender. And it's interesting that whereas women were very prominent in most of the social movements, the peace and human rights movements prior to 1989 in most of these countries, they have not moved into positions of political power. And it seems to me that this indicates something which is also an effect of 1989 and after, and that is a shift in and a reinforcement of the public-private divide. Prior to 1989, the private sphere, the family, the extended friendship networks, and the embryonic civil society, which operated through these small human rights and social movements, took place in the private sphere, in the household, and women were very instrumental in perpetuating and fostering those networks. After 1989, women were the first to become unemployed. They became the majority of the unemployed in all of those countries bar Hungary. They therefore had a more limited access to the public sphere of the marketplace, which in the neoliberal paradigm was the central locus of the citizen as economic actor. And also, it was the men who moved into mainstream politics. Were leaving the women behind as primarily responsible for the household, but which itself had a lesser significance in the new situation of civil and political rights and an enlarged public sphere. I think in this context, if we look at the concept of civil society itself, I want to say just two very brief things about that. One is that I think the concept of civil society so eloquently theorized by Havel, by Michnik, and others prior to 1989 became, after 1989, rather emptied of content because it was a term used so loosely and idealized so greatly. I'll come back to this question of idealization, but I just want to quote Ferenc Mislevitz, a former dissident from Hungary, who said at Sussex in a talk last year, what we dreamed of was civil society. What we got were NGOs. I think that's a very nice, encapsulates quite a lot. And in that respect, I think that, again, going back to the issue of gender, these NGOs are often run by women. And I think there is a danger if we idealize civil society, not only that it becomes dislocated from the centers of power in mainstream politics, and there's no communication between and facilitation of those NGO activities from state level, because partly of the neoliberal paradigm which rejects the role of the state in social provision, so that what women are often doing is filling the vacuum where the state once was and providing on an informal basis social welfare and so forth. Now, this, I think, leads to a problem which I've called the civil society gap or the civil society trap, and it's something which I do think needs to be addressed. I think there need to be new ways of theorizing and indeed of activating the links between states, markets, and households in order to prevent that gap or trap. However, on the positive side, and to end on a positive note, I want to endorse what Tim said about the path-breaking nature and of the non-violence, the kind of revolution. And I think this was really a tribute to social movement networking, East-West, which went on before 89, because the Women for Peace, the Frauenfeld in Frieden, with whom I and we in END were in contact, and indeed together with whom I was imprisoned by the Stasi, and who went on to be founding members of the Initiative for Peace and Freedom in East Germany, and then ultimately in 89 to become leading members of Democracy Now! And New Forum, they in turn, through us perhaps, were influenced by the Greenham women. And from the example of the Greenham women, they took, it seems to me, two things. One was non-violence, a commitment to non-violence. They were, of course, themselves already pacifists, so that wasn't something, in a sense, that they learned. But also a commitment to new and non-hierarchical ways of working, which I think influenced the subsequent round tables and will have a lasting impact on ways of working in politics, and particularly at the civil society level. So it seems to me, and much as Egon Krenz, former member of the Politburo, was in The Guardian a couple of days ago claiming the credit for the non-violent nature of the revolution in East Germany, I would rather say that it was the social movements, and in particular the women's social movements, women's peace movement, in the East German case anyway, who played a very large role in that development of non-violent political tactics. So I would say, to end on a positive note, that the hope for the future that would come out of 1989, looking forward from 1999, even across all the negativities of virulent and exclusionary nationalisms and fortress Europe, the hope for the future lies, I think, in transnational civic initiatives, of which the Helsinki Citizens Assembly, where Mary is very active, is a prime example, and indeed an inheritor, perhaps, of the dream of 1989. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Our last speaker is Michael Cox, who is a professor at the University of Wales in Aberystwyth. He's author of Rethinking the Soviet Collapse, which is available, and he's just written a book on E.H. Carr. You will have a chance of hearing him again Friday the 26th of November here at LSE in the New Theatre at 7:30, where he will give the Isaac Deutscher Memorial Lecture, the 1999 Isaac Deutscher Memorial Lecture. And the title of that lecture is going to be A Tale of Two Exiles, Isaac Deutscher and E.H. Carr. A very special relationship. Michael Cox.
Thank you very much, Mignon. Well, Mary gave me two letters. One said, please speak about the ideas of 1989. The other one talked about the global consequences. Fortunately, I ignored the ideas, and I thought I'd therefore stress the global. As all the other speakers here this evening have talked about the ideas, I think therefore perhaps some sort of extension of the discussion outside of East Central Europe, I think, is quite critical. Simply to get the proper feeling of the international ramifications of 1989 beyond the simple regional one. Perhaps a few opening remarks. One about 1989 itself, or maybe a couple about 1989 of a more general character to those which have already been made. I think the first thing to say about 1989, and social scientists don't like to say this 10 years on, of course, that none of us predicted it. My old friend Fred Halliday, who tells me that social science has got nothing to do about prediction, nevertheless, I do think that some of us still ought to be holding our heads in shame, and perhaps one of the global consequences of 1989 should have been very high unemployment among social scientists and the international relations profession. Because the reality is that all of us were looking the wrong way. The assumptions of both the left and the right, of the liberals, essentially was that the Cold War system in Europe was secure. Bipolarity was secure, the division of Europe would go on forever, and indeed would go on forever for one very simple reason, that it was, in a sense that we all loved it, we worked within it, nobody wanted to overthrow it, and the Soviet Union was going to remain there anyway to keep this stability intact. So I think, you know, when we're reflecting on 1989 and its outcomes, I mean, the first thing I think we need to do is go back to 1987, to 1986, even to the very early period of 1989, where very few, if anybody, predicted this outcome. The assumption was the Cold War in Europe would continue, either because it was a necessity or indeed because it was stabilizing. And I think, in a sense, we need to recall this extraordinary event in the context of our complete inability to predict or anticipate it taking place. The second general remark I want to make really is about the unexpected nature of what actually came out of 1989. I think now we're imposing a nice, neat sort of set of logical connections that from A to B to C to D, and we have finally arrived at E, F, G, and H, and we got basically where we had always intended to go. My reading of it essentially is quite the opposite, that the outcome at the end of this long period, at the end of 1989 and into 1990, was quite unexpected. Not only, therefore, was it unpredicted, I think the actual outcomes were quite unexpected. Let me just take three of the outcomes, which I think were quite unexpected. Between the intention and the outcome, I think there was a huge gap, I think, which we have to be well aware of. Firstly, German unification. This, I think, was something which most West European politicians, and certainly a number of East European politicians, and certainly one or two Soviet politicians at the time, regarded with the utmost horror. It wasn't just Mrs. T who was going around Europe at the time trying to handbag the Germans back into division, even making the great case for the Warsaw Pact in the early period of 1990, remember. In fact, large numbers of people, even inside Germany itself, looked upon the possibility of full German unification on Western terms with great horror. And I think, therefore, the outcome in 1990 of a German unification on Western terms, and then, of course, a united Germany within NATO, was something which I think hardly anybody at any point anticipated as the outcome, least of all, by the way, Gorbachev himself. I recently came back from a conference in Germany where all the policymakers on the German and Soviet side got together, these sort of wonderful round tables where they sort of reminisce over claret. And they reflect about what they did in the whole thing. And it was a very, very interesting conference, because all it in the end showed me, effectively, that very few of them knew what they were doing. And at the end of the day, what they ended up with was isn't what they intended to take place. The second unexpected outcome of 1989 was Soviet collapse in Eastern Europe. This was not Gorbachev's game plan, if he had one at all, in early 1989. What Gorbachev wanted, being, of course, an egoist, was several little Gorbachevs in East Central Europe. His game plan was not the collapse of the whole Comecon system. His game plan was not the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. His game plan, I suppose, if we can put it in rather brutal terms, was a form of social democracy with a sort of within a one-party plural state, if you can have that sort of combination with a mixed economy and a looser set of relationships between the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, but Eastern Europe still remaining within something we might call, loosely speaking, a sphere of influence. That is not what the outcome was. If one actually wants to believe that Gorbachev was the great man of 1989, fine, but what he ended up with and what he wanted, I think, are two entirely different things. In a sense, what collapsed in 1989 as well, and I think this is part of the global consequence, is the third way. In a sense, what Gorbachev wanted was a third way. He wanted to believe there was a possibility. Take East Germany. I think this is the classic example where everybody believed the possibility of a third way, and look what happened to it. In some senses, I would say that The third way was destroyed in 1989 itself. It wasn't just communism which collapsed, however you want to define Eastern Europe in 1989. What also collapsed was a possibility or a belief that there could be a third way of a mixed market economy as well. And I think highly paradoxical, of course, that this corpse, which in a sense was buried very deep in the ground of East Central Europe in 1989, has been revived more recently by one or two people in this environment. The third, almost totally unexpected outcome of 1989, and one, of course, that Mr. Gorbachev himself paid for, was, of course, the disintegration of the Soviet Union itself. I am not one of these who believes that Gorbachev, I mean, I think Gorbachev played a key historical role, and I think for that we should all thank him. I'm not sure he had any control over the processes he was involved in. And by the way, listening to his policy advisors 2 or 3 weeks ago in Munich, the more I listened to them, the less I could believe for 1 minute that anybody had any understanding of what was really going on. But I think one of the consequences, and again a quite unexpected one, and a quite unintended one, and one which was actually deeply unwelcome, was of course the disintegration of the Soviet Union itself 2 years later. I don't think there obviously is a connection between the two things. Clearly the Soviet Union disintegrated for all sorts of reasons, but what happened in 1989, I think, sealed the fate of the Soviet Union in at least two senses. Firstly, it weakened Gorbachev's position at home. There's no question, if you look through the discussions through 1990 and into 1991, Gorbachev's position was severely weakened with inside the Soviet elite itself, and I think that in itself prepared the way. More importantly, of course, failing to use force in East Central Europe, it was increasingly impossible to use force to hold the Soviet Union together itself. So, an unpredicted event, and one with at least three major unintended and unexpected outcomes. What were the consequences in the global sense? Well, if 1989, if we can put it like this, brought the Cold War to an end, and I remain a sort of rather essentialist on this issue. It did end in 1989. I don't think it ended sometime earlier. I don't think it's still going on. Then what happened 2 years later was also equally important. It ended a bipolar world. And the two things, although connected, have to be analyzed separately, because the end of the Cold War ended one set of relationships. The collapse of the Soviet Union ended bipolarity. And what that meant, very simply, in global terms, was we begin to live in a world in which we now inhabit, a world dominated by the United States. And if I was to say, therefore, what has been the most central, important global consequence of 1989 through the reverberations of that into 1991, is that we live in a world now more dominated, more shaped, more organized, more hegemonized by the United States than at any point since 1945. Now, one may say this is a good thing, one may say this is a bad thing. The Guardian the other day even recognized it was happening. But nevertheless, it is a reality. Now, let me take you back briefly to 1988 and the most misjudged best-selling book in the world by Paul Kennedy, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. They couldn't buy the book quickly enough in the United States. Even the hardback copy was selling, which for an academic, of course, is almost an unknown experience, particularly if you published with Macmillan, by the way. Now, and in this situation, I mean, Kennedy, I mean, in this brilliantly researched book, was talking very, very in analogical terms about the decline of the United States. In 1988, what a wonderful sense of timing. Because in 1989, of course, Eastern Europe collapses, and 2 years later, the Soviet Union collapses. And I've been currently doing the circuit with a particular talk, which is called Whatever Happened to American Decline, or The Rise and Fall of American Decline. And I quite like that one too, actually. And I think, and if Oxford would do it in paperback, I'd be very, very happy. But I think it is an extraordinary transformation that for 20 years, the issue about American decline, where America was going downwards, for whatever particular reason, was a dominant theme in both the academic and in the foreign policy debate in the United States. It generated the whole discussions in the 70s and the 80s. Reaganism was a response to it. Even in the very late part of the 1980s, people could still talk seriously of that. Nobody any longer talked seriously of that at all, whether at the foreign policy level or at the academic level. And this, of course, has policy consequences. Now, I think there's from my own perspective, and as you know, I don't like sitting on the fence on these issues, I do think a lot of nonsense has been talked about American foreign policy in the 1990s. As America Without a Mission, by the way, that was the title of my book. I did actually put a question mark at the end of it, I should point out as well, just like the Webbs. America in isolationism, various other things. I mean, a whole sort of clatter of babble, really, about what America was getting wrong, ignoring the fundamental objective fact of American power. And if one looks at key situation after key situation in the 1990s, at the end of the day, whether rightly, wrongly, late or early, badly, indecisively, in the key situation, or most of those key situations, it has been the United States which has been the key player. Indeed, one of the weirdest things which I think has happened in the 1990s, that all those who were opposed, or many of those liberals and people on the left who were opposed to American intervention before the end of the Cold War, have become so much in favor of American intervention since the end of it. Please do more. We want more liberal imperialism, the sort of liberal imperialism, of course, that many of us on the left and on the liberal wing of politics were denouncing. But it seems to me that at each critical moment in the Gulf or in ex-Yugoslavia, even in Asia-Pacific today, it is the United States. Here I would take one point of issue with the first speaker, with Neil. I simply do not see Russia coming back at all. I think what one is contemplating here, quite frankly, Neil, is simply a consistent meltdown. At what point Russia can continue to decline, I simply do not know. But I think it is simply... I simply think it is empirically wrong to believe that. In fact, one of the real paradoxes of the 1990s in terms of the global consequence is that you now have the United States desperately trying to prop up what remains of Russia. They really do want Russia to get stronger. They really do want the market reforms to succeed. They really do want Russia to come back. And I think this is symptomatic of a real worry they now have. Their real worry, Neil, I think, is not that Russia's coming back, that Russia's disintegration will continue, and its destabilizing consequences throughout the whole of the Asia-Pacific region, I think, is clear. I was going to say a few words about globalization. I think globalization isn't just the consequence of 1989, but it is obviously accelerated by 1989. But I do want to maybe make one or two other interventions here, because the story can't end just at that point. The good news. Let me give you the good news first before I sort of send you home completely miserable. I think the good news about the global consequence of 1989 is it has clearly been its impact on certain regional conflicts. I mean, if one is talking about the consequences, the outcomes of 1989, that it is inconceivable, for instance, to think of the whatever one thinks of the settlements in South Africa and what its consequences are without the end of the Cold War. Without 1989, it doesn't seem to me feasible to contemplate the settlement in South Africa. It seems to me inconceivable to think of the settlement, however one judges that settlement, and however permanent that settlement is going to be, even in the Middle East. And as I've written as well, because I lived in Northern Ireland for over 20 years, I think even the end of the Cold War, combined with other factors, has also played a role in bringing about the dynamics of the peace process, even in Northern Ireland itself. I think there are connections. That is the good news. In many ways, a number of unresolved regional conflicts, which were going nowhere and killing lots of people and causing an enormous amount of misery, many of those have been resolved and have been resolved because essentially of the withdrawal of the Soviet Union as an international actor and at the end of the Cold War more generally. What is the bad news? Well, I think the bad news is this, and I put this in my most provocative way possible, if I might, and I hope you don't all leave, is that in some senses the Cold War kept us honest, or put it another way, the Soviet Union kept the West on its toes. The Soviet Union, in a sense, wasn't, I don't think, ever a threat. Mary and I often polemicized with other people about that. We were always quite skeptical about the notion of the Soviet Union being a threat. We didn't like the Soviet Union, the idea that somehow or another the socialists were terribly upset by the collapse of 1989 is complete gibberish. I mean, I wasn't. I'm jubilant. But in a way, in the larger historical sense, I think what the Soviet Union, in a sense, performed an historical function, if you want to put it like this, of keeping the West on its toes. Keeping the United States on its toes. That when it took economic decisions, for instance, it had to think of political consequences because there was always an alternative. There was always a possibility that the market order could be overthrown. And in a sense, we now live in a world without alternatives, it would appear, where the West doesn't have to think about political consequences of its economic decision making, where indeed it can take economic decisions along the neoliberal economic lines, always knowing the people will suffer, the inequality will grow, but there's never going to be a political backlash in any serious sense at all. And it isn't so surprising, therefore, that in the 1990s, and I think this is a global consequence of 1989, that we've seen increasing inequality throughout the world, increasing inequality throughout the countries of East Central Europe, and increasing inequalities within and between the major capitalist countries. Which I think leads me to the conclusion about the paradox of 1989, that it was, of course, a movement for political freedom, combining nationalism as well, as Neil, I think, correctly reminds us. It was a movement for political pluralism, and it was a movement which has expanded the areas of democracy in the world. I think it would be absurd to say anything other than that. On the other hand, accompanying this, there has been greater inequality, a more aggressive capitalism in the world, and a much greater disregard for the consequences of economic decisions taken by the great and the powerful in Washington. So, in that sense, therefore, there is good news about 1989, but I think there's also a lot of bad news, and there's a lot of consequences of that which are hurting a lot of people in the world today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now. Now we've got some time for questions, and there are rowing microphones around. And it would be equitable and fair for people to ask short questions, because that is good for your other question askers. And if you make a speech, I'll cut you off. Who wants to ask the first question? The gentleman in the front.
Before I ask my question, just very briefly for Professor Einhorn, I do not in any way defend that wall between the Romanis and the whites in the Czech Republic, but I think it's very important to remember it's not a wall enclosing anyone, it's a straight wall between two communities.
Yeah.
Minor point, but the Czechs insist on it, and they are carrying
themselves
about it.
Can you speak up? I can't hear you with your microphone on.
Is this on? Is this on?
Yeah. Stand up.
All right, I'll stand up. Particularly for Mr. Acheson and Professor Cox, given your disagreement about whether or not the Russia is down for good, what is the significance of the expansion of NATO and presumably the European Union further east, possibly right up to Russia's borders? Is that or not?
Thank you.
Clearly, it is a worry to Russia. My hope is that the enlargement of NATO will be completed and accepted, really, long before what I still expect to happen, which is that Russia will revive and will become again strong. Strong as what is the question. But anyway, by that time, I would hope that there will be no open questions about NATO membership, and that the border, though inevitably to be resented wherever it lies, of the NATO states will be more or less accepted as a reality by this new Russia. However, that may not be so. We do not know what sort of Russia it is. The thing is that all the recipes and attempt to construct from outside a new kind of free market Russia appear to me to have failed, and they may, and this I would agree with Michael, I think they may have failed in a secular way, which means that what will eventually emerge may be, you know, a very big authoritarian regime which is also devoted to the cause of, as it were, recuperating not necessarily Bolshevik socialism, but the cause of other countries which have suffered by the infliction of globalization and the free market, which has been to their disadvantage, and that Russia would, curiously enough, once again become a magnet, self-consciously, for that particular part of the world. And I can foresee that happening.
Well, very, very briefly, I was speaking to the American ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock, a few weeks ago, and a promise was given to Gorbachev by the Americans
by NATO that there will be no expansion of NATO in 1990. A promise, a firm, clear, unambiguous promise was given to them that Germany in NATO no further. There was no need for it, there was no necessity, and that any move in that direction would undercut Gorbachev and would not bring necessary security to the whole of Europe, including with that, within that, by the way, Russia. And I think it is part of the process of betrayal of certain promises which were made and, you know, seriously entered into in 1990, promises given by the US and by the West to the Soviet Union on this issue. Now, we are now stuck with it. We are now stuck with it, and it, in a sense, becomes an irreversible process. I think it was a daft move in the first place, and I think its outcomes are not necessarily going to enhance the security of the whole of Europe. One should not be surprised, however, down the line, and already it's happening inside the former Soviet Union, inside Russia, that many Russian nationalists, Zhuganov and the rest, the Red-Brown Alliance and all these various people, turn around and say the West has betrayed them. And that is going to have some consequences. It is already having consequences politically with inside Russia. And if in the end we get a Zhuganov presidency instead of our nice Mr. Yeltsin, if we get a Zhuganov presidency, then maybe one of the factors in creating the conditions which made that possible was our going back on the promises which were made to the Soviet Union back in 1990.
Could I just briefly, first of all, if I understand Michael right, I agree with him rather than Neil. I think the danger for the next 10 years, and I think it's the biggest danger in Europe altogether, is not the strength of Russia, but its weakness.
Yeah.
It is the disintegration of Russia with the consequence that we face nuclear terrorism in the arms of either nationalities or just mafia groups. But I wanted to come in specifically on this point about NATO enlargement, because Michael was quoting a higher authority, Jack Matlock. Well, I can quote an even higher one, because I chaired a discussion on Monday evening between Kohl, Gorbachev, and Bush in Berlin. A rather remarkable event. And I asked them specifically this question. Yeah. Were promises made about no further eastward enlargement of NATO? And the answer was essentially no. What Gorby said was, and I think he should know, even better than Jack Matlock, is, Jim Baker said things to me on the 9th of February 1990 about we have no plans at the moment to go beyond taking in Germany, which he would say that, but Gorby did not feel, and you know, he's opposed to NATO enlargement, he did not feel that, you know, this had been a solemn, binding promise on the part of the West. It was a specific commitment in the specific comment of talks about German unification, and he didn't feel that the West should be bound forevermore by that.
Okay. Mary Calder.
Mary, I think you're being... Oh, you want me? You want the mic.
Well, first of all, I want to apologize for the confusing instructions.
Okay. Don't make a speech.
No, I'm not going to make a speech. Actually, what I wanted you all to talk about was the global significance of the ideas of 1989.
Ah, no.
And I think you did a brilliant job.
Start again, John.
I think that's exactly what you did. I just wanted to make one very, very short, Meghnad, comment, which is that I think those ideas to which, in fact, Neil, Tim, and Barbara alluded, the whole idea about how you do things, round tables, based on self-organized spaces, and so on, was a really fantastically new idea that we have which we won't recognize how new that is for a long time to come. And I do think if you look at global politics today, even if civil society is only NGOs, nevertheless, the incredible growth of NGOs, the way in which, in the West as well as in the East, and the way in which they relate to international institutions is very new. And in terms, you know, there may still be nation states and political parties, as Tim says, but they're very different in character from what they used to be. And the sites of political debates, important political debates, which affect our lives, have changed. So I want to get some kind of comment from you about that.
Can I not consider that as a question?
No.
Gentleman there. Yeah, you.
I'd like to ask a question to the panel. I think that Michael Cox has already answered it. And
why do you want to ask it?
What are the main what are the main features of the new worlds, this post-Cold War worlds, and who did win and who did lose? In terms of nations and regions, international regions.
Okay, do you want to see who won, who lost?
Who won?
You say who won, he says who lost.
Who won?
Who won? Who won and who lost?
It's an obvious one.
Well, who won in 1989? Well,
we all lost, didn't we?
You know, what happened was that everybody was sort of there for the great duel, and suddenly one contestant threw his pistol down, went home and died, leaving a completely amazed other party in command of the battlefield, so to speak. That's my view. Who won? Well, there's a sense in which we all won.
But I think it was an odd duel, because the one thing, you know, the other duelist knew, namely Gorbachev, was that he never was going to use his pistol. Michael is absolutely right about all Gorbachev's illusions, both in advance and in retrospect. Third way, all of that's perfectly true, but the one thing he bloody well did know and insisted on was no violence. So, it's the peculiar combination of the man at the top in the Soviet Union who insists on that and opposition elites who make it a basic principle. Second point, winners and losers. I think we can be a bit more crude about this. Russia loses. Germany wins. The Central Europeans on the whole win. The Balkans on the whole lose. That's the verdict after 10 years. The great winner of all of them is Germany.
I just want to make a brief, it's not even a comment, I just want to read you something which bears on winners and losers. GDP per head, Germany, £28,000. United Kingdom, £15,000 minus. Czech Republic, £3,400. Hungary, £2,900. Portugal, £6,400. Greece, £7,062. Romania, £1,100, Bulgaria, £875. That's about winners and losers.
Well, I also want to say, I think in terms of social groups, that there are winners and losers. I already indicated that I think that women are at the moment, at least in the short term or medium term, have been losers. I think that ethnic groups, discriminated groups, groups who are made into enemies, such as Romani, such as the Albanians in Kosovo, are the losers. I think we mustn't lose sight of the fact that we have got new exclusionary mechanisms which are excluding large groups of people, would-be migrants and asylum seekers into the EU likewise.
Well, I'll be blunt. Who wins? The United States. There's a very interesting book, which is entirely wrong, called We All Lost the Cold War. I don't ever understand quite what that means. The United States, for whatever reason, I'm not saying that Reagan did it. I'm not going to get into that nonsense. But, in the end, the United States emerges as the winner. And the point I was trying to really ram home in a deeply and appallingly realist way, which is very, very unpopular in Aberystwyth, I can point out to you, is essentially this point, that one pole goes and the other pole is left there in a position of extraordinary self-confidence. Now, that self-confidence may be all a bubble. It may be all based on other things as well, the failure of Europe in the Balkans, the collapse of Asia Pacific, whatever happened to the Asia Pacific 21st century, that's also gone. No matter whether that's a consequence, but you know, the United States is in a moment of extraordinary self-confidence, and I think that is clearly connected to what actually happened in 1989-1991. Second winner, capitalism. I don't love Francis Fukuyama. I wanted a radio program with him, which is the most peculiar experience I ever did, on Afghanistan, of all things. This is when he was writing about those sorts of things. But in some senses, liberal capitalism is the winner. I mean, we cannot tootle around this. You know, I mean, that is also the winner. The great loser, if I want to put it not in terms of powers, in terms of the left is the loser. The left is the loser. There is, I mean, whatever we thought the left was, however critical the left happened to be of the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. Most people I knew were fantastically critical of the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. The whole of the left has been thrown into what many would regard as a temporary, what some regard, hopefully, as a permanent crisis. The left has still not recovered from the consequences of 1989. We therefore live in a world which I would actually characterize almost as a non-political world in terms of the old world of choices which we once had. In that sense, the left, is one of the key critical losers and has still not got back up off its back after. If it can ever do so, of course, remains a long-term historical question.
Okay. gentleman there. No, the one. Oh, fine. You.
John Coleman, New European. One thing I haven't heard anything about in this discussion has been what I think of as the Cinderella of the European institutions, the Council of Europe. And it has, over the past decade, recently been a book out by Denis Hubert about how the countries of Eastern Europe have at least been taken into the Council of Europe and been given some kind of chance and hope there. And I just wondered if people would make some comment on what they feel about the future of that institution.
Anybody care to comment on the Council of Europe?
Oh, don't do Europe.
I think it didn't matter and it won't matter. Thank heavens.
Sorry?
It didn't matter and it won't matter is my view of Council of Europe.
Well, I think William Wallace.
I have to disagree with our chairman there. I mean, I think it didn't matter. It won't matter, but it should matter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe it should, but it doesn't.
It's the only European institution that is concerned centrally with democracy and human and civil rights. But where I think the suggestion of the wise men, of Prodi's wise men, is one of the many ways in which I think it's a very good suggestion, is saying when you write your EU constitution, please put human and civil rights, right in there at the top of the constitution, because at the moment you have this absurd situation that you have the EU as a central European institution and human and civil rights are really not its concern.
Okay. Now, gentleman there. Yes. I want to bring the question of gender around. So many women present seem to be interested in that, and the men seem to be interested in what Gorbachev said or what the Americans said. My question is, I'm not going to make a speech. My question is the public and private division analogous or the same thing
as the booklet of the Socialist History Society, to which I'm a member, said of the personal
and the political.
Forgotten the other word.
And the political.
The personal.
Personal and the political.
Personal and the political.
That's right.
That's correct.
You've all been through all the cliches.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Barbara, this is your question. Very gender biased thing to do.
Absolutely.
It's your question, Barbara. Yes, in that sense, I just want to underline what you said. It's very interesting. This is my question because I'm the token woman here and I'm the person who speaks to gender and nobody else takes an interest. I take your point on that. The other people talk about male politicians.
Mrs. Thatcher. We talk about Mrs. Thatcher.
Mrs. Thatcher doesn't count.
No, she's an honorary male.
All right, okay.
The public-private divide is not the same as the personal is political. Mm. The personal is political was a slogan of second-wave feminists in the West who sought to force into the public domain issues such as violence against women, which had remained hidden under the notion that the state regulation stops at the garden gate. They forced rape within marriage, for example, into the courts in this country recently, and issues of domestic violence to the police. The public-private divide is something which feminist political theorists have pointed out has bedeviled women's citizenship rights in mainstream political theory throughout. That women have been confined to the private sphere while men in the 19th century went out and sullied their hands, middle class men went out and sullied their hands in the world, the amoral world of capital, came home to the angel of the hearth to be purified and spiritually regenerated. In the East Central European context, the public-private divide had a different significance, as I said before, because the private sphere was the only haven from the long arm of the state prior to 1989. In the post-1989 situation, you have a reinscription, actually, of a rather traditional and even patriarchal family structure in which women are responsible, for the private sphere, and men venture out into the public spheres of the labour market and politics. And in the neoliberal paradigm, as I pointed out, it is the public sphere of the market seen as the sole regulator of society, which where the citizen is construed partly as the consumer, but also as the economic actor with the ability to exchange contracts in the marketplace, and to which this public sphere, as I said, women have limited access, partly because of the contraction of the state and the withdrawal of such social provision, therefore, as childcare facilities.
Mm. Anybody else want to comment on that? Lady there.
I'd just like to ask, seeing as this is about the global significance of the ideas of 1989, how much do you view the ideas of 1989 as something to do with Europe? Do you think that the ideas of 1989 could have a, in the future perhaps, not yet, but could have an important role in Asia, especially China, Korea?
Who wants to
take? Well, I'll have a quick go. I mean, in terms of my interpretation of who won and who lost, then the consequence of 1989 globally, I mean, and in Asia Pacific and China and in the Third World was enormous. I mean, essentially what people saw happening in 1989 was a collapse of what they, in Rudolf Barrow's term, was actually existing socialism. That's what they saw collapse. That was the perception of what happened in 1989. What also happened in 1989 was something which also had an enormous impact, namely the belief that the Soviet Union, or this happened in 1990 and 1991 as well, that the Soviet Union would support national liberation struggles. So in terms of global consequences, I think there's, I mean, if it wants to extend it far beyond Europe, and I think one should, one had to be in parts of the Third World to see what the consequences were
of the events in East Central Europe in 1989. And they were read essentially that basically communism has failed, the way forward has to be the market, there is no alternative to the market. That's how it was read in Latin America, that's how it's been interpreted in places like in Africa and large parts of Asia. And if you then added to that the sort of the assumption of the whole national liberation movements of the 70s and 80s, all of which feel like Fred has written about extremely well, I mean, but all those collapsed as well. And that was also part and parcel of this same retreat, as it was perceived by many, if you like, on the progressive political wing of politics. And in those terms, although I think, you know, there's positive outcomes, I mean, I'm not doubting any of those, and democracy is one of those, I would see that as being something which goes far beyond the boundaries of Europe and had consequences in Peru, in Colombia, in large parts of Africa and Asia, which I think we seriously should not underestimate. This was not simply regarded as a European event. This was regarded as an event with world historical significance, and correctly so.
Barbara. Well, I'll take all around.
One of the things we haven't addressed on the question of global significance, I think, is the relationship between economic globalization and what is happening in Europe. And in Europe, as we've already said, there is already a paradoxical or contradictory movement between transcending the nation state in the EU, but in the same process creating an exclusionary fortress Europe, and on the other hand, fragmentation into small nation states, often very exclusionary nationalisms. Now, this is in a way stands in contradiction to the idea that in the face of economic globalization, the power of the nation state to legislate is in fact less. And an example of that is, for example, in China, in the special economic zones, where there have been cases of young women from the countryside working for multinational corporations being locked into a factory, a fire breaks out and they die. And speaking to the Chinese All China Women's Federation, they say, well, the state actually has very little power to do anything about those working conditions. This is something I think we need to think about. What is the link between whatever it is that's happening in Europe in relation to the nation state or the supranational state and the actually diminishing power of the nation state in the face of economic globalization? And this is where actually I think the power of the networking, the transnational networking power of social movements shouldn't be underestimated. In the issue of the European Journal of Women's Studies that I guest edited called The Idea of Europe, Sheila Robotham has an article about the least powerful or the most powerless workers who are networking internationally through the net, and that is home workers, both male and female. So, you know, that maybe the nation state in some senses is becoming irrelevant.
Up to a point. I understand what we were meant to be talking about, Mary. That's very nice.
We're getting there at the end.
I think I was in a way talking about it at the beginning too, because I do think that at the end of the day still the global significance of the ideas of 1989 is this model of the peaceful revolution. And I don't think anything else that was thrown up by 1989, including, I'm afraid, you won't be glad to hear, the sort of the vision of civil society really does hold up that well. I mean, I'm afraid I agree with Barbara completely here. You know, instead of civil society, you have NGOs, i.e. instead of real grass, you have AstroTurf. You know, and that's in a way part of the problem too, much as I love NGOs. But global significance, Asia, we say the end of communism, actually a fifth of mankind is still living under some version of a communist system. What 1989 offered was a way of transforming the political system of communism into something else, something closer to liberal democracy, without violence not unimportant in the case of one-fifth of humankind. In the short term, what 1989 did in China was actually to make things worse. Why? Because the regime was watching Eastern Europe closely too, and it saw, it drew its own lessons from solidarity and from what happened in 89. It saw, if you give an inch, they'll take a mine. If you allow these intellectuals to get together with the workers, and this was the key moment in the summer of 1989, to get together with the workers, then it's curtains for the nomenclatura, and that's one of the main reasons they clamped down. On the other hand, the oppositions, not just in China, but also in Burma, Aung San Suu Kyi, for example, are very closely studying what happened in Central Europe and then what happened, as Michael rightly said, developing this model in South Africa, in the Middle East, even in Northern Ireland. There is a whole body, as it were, of case law of peaceful revolution which is being built up, which I think is one of the great positive developments of the 1990s. The Chinese opposition is studying it closely, and you know, if that trick can be brought off again in China, then 1989 really will have a global legacy. But it takes two to tango. And that the partner in power is not there yet.
I just want to say something about China, first of all, because in a way China relates to Richard Kapuscinski's series of books about power, which were devoted to the idea that the attempt to have development without democracy, the dream of all autocrats, is always doomed. Now, of course, the fact about China is that they have brought that off to an extraordinary extent. And so development, you know, a degree of the free market in private life, a free market economy on the land, industrially to some extent, commerce, all that has gone ahead. It has absolutely transformed Chinese society. Many people feel not for the better, but nonetheless it certainly has. And this has gone without, so far, creating the kind of enormous consequential fissures in political power which would have arisen in a European society, for example. I mean, make no mistake, the Chinese regime is doomed. But it may take some time. Mostly these things happen quicker than you think. Now, the second thing I wanted to say is simply to speak a word for the poor old NGOs. Because, of course, one of the global consequences of 1989 has been an enormous invasion of the empty space, as it were, left by the collapsing institutions and assumptions of the Cold War by NGOs of a new kind, campaigning, often quite politicized, expert at summoning the attention of governments and alliances. And this enormous, really quite unprecedented presence in the world, power in the world, which exists in many nations in many ways. You can say that one part of the world tends to dominate this area, but nonetheless, I think that it is an enormous new development. END, in a sense, was set a number of very interesting precedents in the 1980s for what these NGOs were going to do in the 1990s and what they're continuing to do. I mean, this is a huge force in the world. It is something with which particularly, I think, everybody under 35 reckons seriously as, you know, a big moral force in the world, as a possibility, something one could be associated with or could work with. And this is really quite new. If you think of the scale on which NGOs operated internationally before 1989, I mean, you're really just talking about what used to be called charities.
Well, thank you all very much. Now, we've got to 7:30 and beyond. I just want to thank our four speakers very much. They've given you a marvelous, detailed,
four lectures plus lots of detailed answers to questions. Thank them, and there is a reception upstairs on the fifth floor in the senior dining room. Thank you all for coming.